Nee, Wind. Zij schiet mijn stuk nieder. Wat zeggen ze nu? Always serious, and I wanted all of us to be the same. My father had a good deal of native humor, and most of the stories I remember. That took place in my very young days. My early home life, my adventures, and the characters that lived in the little village of Crossachelly. My mother was a good teller of stories, but she seldom had time. She was the busiest body in the parish. She was never flippant. She always seemed serious and wanted all of us to be the same. My father had a good deal of native humor, and most of the stories I remember were told to him by the neighbors dropping in to our house for a couche in the evenings. My father, born in an old house at Oristel, now demolished, went to the school at the parish church. The master was the parish clerk, Thomas Quattro, Tommy Dick Nancy, he was called. He was a shoemaker and plied his trade in the school while his wife put the children through their lessons. My father was born on New Year's Day, 1829, so that the date of the story I'm going to tell was about 1840. During the lesson one morning, the dead bell was rung. The schoolroom was only a few yards from the belfry. The school was, I am told, actually within the ground embraced by the churchyard wall, but has since been brought into the burial ground. Great silence followed the first of the tolling. The master, looking up from his job, said, "Eilish, who's dead, do thou think?" She replied, "Old Camod, Ballacrink. They've been waiting a flock of days for him. God rest him." The old mistress then went on, "Boys, come say, come say," and they went on with the lesson. The custom in those days was that some relative or friend of the departed, as soon after the death as possible, was expected to go to the parish church and swing the bell four times and to allow 1 minute's silence between each tolling. It was not necessary to have the permission of either the vicar or the clerk. The silence after the second tolling was broken by the master. Looking up to his wife, he said, "Eilish, another 18 pence for us." That was the parish clerk's burial fee. The Quattro family had been a parish clerks for generations. Tommy Dick Nancy was the last of them to receive what was called the clerk's plough groat. In the Russian vestry accounts for 1859, there is recorded a resolution that the plough groat must in future be paid to the clerk out of the parish cess, and it was commuted to £1 a year. The plough groat, as part of the clerk's emoluments, was established by custom, going back certainly to the 16th century. Every farmer who worked a plough had to pay the clerk a groat every year. My mother has told me of her girlhood days in Kirkcaldy. She was a fairly good singer and was in the choir. When she would be coming home from church, women would be waiting for her at their door to say, "Maggie, what's the day of the month?" She would be able promptly to reply, as she had shortly before heard Parson Alexander Gelling say in the course of the service, "The collect for the day, the 22nd day of the month," or whatever day it might have been. This was useful information, for many had no almanac. Even in these days of almanacs and diaries, we often do not know the day of the month, nor sometimes even of the day of the week. As a girl, she was a favourite at the vicarage. The wife of the vicar would sometimes, in the early summer, send her to gather primroses. With these, she made primrose tea, that is, the vicar's wife. There was, near her house, an old woman, nearly blind, who took snuff. Mother's duty was to roast a tobacco leaf before a turf fire and rub it down very fine, and this was her snuff. As a girl, Mother was in the parish church choir, and on Christmas Eve there would be in the church the singing of carols. There was another choir also in the parish. It was called the Borders Choir. Its leader was a great music man named Cannell. He had a school on the estate of Balladoole, on which there were a number of houses and crofts called the Birders. There was a mighty keen interest taken all over the parish in the singing of these two choirs, each having their own followers. When the parish choir sat down, the Birders choir got up, and the congregation was divided as to the musical merits of each. This program was more exciting to my mother by the singing of the old carols. Some were given in the Manx Gaelic and others were given in English. It was one of the experiences that my mother remembered with the greatest pleasure, and she never ceased to praise the musical ability of the Cannell family of the Borders. Mother was born and brought up in Kirkcaldy, and often called to mind stories of her old home at Ardery, owned by the Comishes of Ballycomish. Here's a story of old Joss Comish, with whom she lived as a relative. The date would be about 1845. The old man had come home from a visit to Neddy Gawne of Kintrow, the brewer and banker. After sitting down in the big armchair, he took off his beaver top hat and dropped from it on to the table a shower of 5-shilling card money of Gawne's bank. He had been to Neddy Gawne to pay for the barrels of ale that he had drunk during the past year, and in order to complete the deal, he had to part with one of his own fields. When she was in her teens, mother walked from Kirkcaldy with another girl to Peel, to see the Peel Hiring Fair on St. Patrick's Day, March the 17th. It was only for women and girls. Her companion was hired, and Mother came home alone. She had only gone for a skeet. She was told by an old Kirkcaldy woman that when she was going through Kirkmaurown, she must take rest at St. Patrick's Chair, for if she did and blessed St. Patrick, in after life her back would never be weary. Now, the story I am going to give you now goes back to 1873, when I was 8 years old. The day was a quiet, a peaceful one. The whole of the week before had been very stormy. More than a score of Nickies and Luggers had gone to Kinsale for the mackerel fishing. There was great fear that there was dire trouble for them. It was rumoured that one had sunk off the Tusker. Soon after midday, I was on the little street by the pump in front of the four little houses at Crossacaley, where we lived. I saw the telegraph man from Port St. Mary come to the street with a telegram envelope in his hand. He said, "Sonny, where's Mrs. Christian's house?" I said, "I don't know. There's no Mrs. Christian here." Then I went and told my mother, and she sent the messenger to the house he wanted. I never knew her as Mrs. Christian. I only knew her as Dick Jemmy Begg's wife. The sum of 1 shilling was paid to the post office by receivers of telegrams in those days. Poor Mrs. Christian had no shilling, and my mother, to my great joy, went upstairs to a drawer and got the shilling for the messenger. I had, as a youngster, seemed to have developed the quality of a skeet. I was curious to see what would happen. Mrs. Christian, I saw, had put the brown-coloured envelope on the little round table. She hadn't opened it. I can still see the old body with her shoulder shawl and white apron sitting in her armchair. Tears were, I think, already falling from her eyes. She didn't dare to open the envelope for fear it carried the message that Tom, her youngest boy, had perished in the storm. Her eyes were still kept fastened on the envelope. Looking up, she saw me at the door, and after another spell she said to me, "Go to Mrs. Gary, will he, and tell her I want her." Mrs. Gary came. She saw the envelope and the crying woman, who asked her to open the envelope. Mrs. Gary said she would rather not, as she couldn't read. They both were certain that poor Tom, the favourite of the village, was drowned. Sure enough, the skipper and crew of the Lady Mary had perished off the Tusker. I can still hear the plaintive coosh of these two old cronies, the one uttering moans that would be proper at a wake, while rubbing her eyes with her white apron, Mrs. Gary, kind soul she was, comforting her. There were no signs of the envelope being opened. I, being still a silent spectator by the door, was sent to tell my mother to come. She was in the middle of baking soda cakes, but she came at once. She saw the two women sitting at the table, both weeping. Mrs. Christian, pointing to the telegram, asked her to open it. This my mother did, and read the message aloud. It ran, "Arrived, Kinsale, all right. Send me clean shirts by Cowley's daughter." In my young days, I only remember one person who had Manx only atom. He had been the farm hand of digging in Crossacaley, but was too old to do any work. I remember him passing our house one very dark day in winter. He was bent with age and used a stick. Looking up with difficulty to the black clouds above, he said, "The storm kit, Gaius Fliaga Magadan." Mother was fairly good at the Manx, and she told me that he said, "There is storm a coming, and wind, and rain too." It was from old Bavi Gari that this curious folk saying came. I don't know the significance of it, but it is suggestive. When the fern is in the loop, the gibbon is in the sand. When the red frapjag is open, the ballon is at the rock. The first portion seems to tell the time for digging for gibbons on the shore, and the second portion the time for fishing a ballon. Another name for frapjag is slaggan slew, fairy fingers, fox club. The only time I have seen a man using a flail was about 1875. Flailing was generally done by two men, striking alternate strokes. The flailer I saw at work was Tom Trumbull, the smith at Crossacaley. He had only a few fields up the Burrough, and he had little corn to flail. Next door to our house lived a family named Comish. The father was a miner working at Ballycorkish lead mine. One day, while he was working down the bottom of a shaft, a big stone fell and struck him in the head, wounding him very seriously. He, it is said, climbed the ladders to the surface and walked home a distance of fully a mile. When he got home, he expired. I well remember the funeral. He was a tall man, like all of the Comishes of Ballycomish, so tall that the coffin had to be slid from above through the window on a wooden plank. There was no employer's liability in those days, and the widow and a family of seven or eight young children were in dire distress. The widow was a proud body, being a nain, and she worked hard to keep the wolf from the door. She got the idea that she could run a little shop in her home, although there was already one which seemed to meet ample requirements. She asked the vicar, Hugh Stolgill, if she could get from the wardens £10 on loan to start the shop. They not only agreed, but made a free gift to her of the £10. I can never forget what followed. She walked down to Castletown and bought from Mullacrease's shop £10 worth of provisions of all sorts. Soap, soda, paraffin oil, treacle, cheese, tea, sugar, and above all, jars of taffy and sweets. As much as possible was displayed in the very little window, and the rest on the table in the little kitchen. I need only say that every bit of edible stuff was eaten by the members of the family in 3 weeks, and all that was left was the soap and paraffin oil, and I must admit that I had a hand in the affair. Well, now, to finish this, I will tell a little story of Kirk Braddon. It's told to me by Jackie Dan Canine. And he went on in this way. In the days when Donald McAbui had a Hualien in the train of Balavru, and when the family of Macria were the holders of Ballymarther in the treen of Ballycristery, they dwelt in Miller in Ballywillion of the name of McQuine. His was the only mill in the long valley of East Ballin from Castle Ward up to the slopes of Craig Cowan. All of the farmers, big and little, were bound to give their moisture to the miller of Ballywillion, for had he not the Lord's license for which he paid to the Lord's receiver the sum of 11 shillings a year? And when he was not able to pay the money, he paid his rent in 1 furlet of barley, 1 kishen of oats, a mutton, a goose, 12 carloads of turf, and 1.5 boon days, in good time before the feast of St. Michael. The miller had a son, Gilbert, and when his father was a journey, he looked after the mill. The father, on a certain day in summertime, was paying the Lord's rent and left Gilbert to grind the corn. Before going away early in the morning, the father said, "When thou hast ground the Ballymarther barley, put through the mill the barley of Ardwellion, and mind thou take out the fuyu." The fuyu, I should explain, or Mr. Canin explained, was the miller's wages, taken in the form of a proportion of the meal ground. The boy agreed, and the father went on his way. When he returned in the evening, the miller questioned the boy, "Whose corn art thou putting through, Gibbon?" That was his pet name for Gilbert. "Ardwellion barley," answered the boy. "And have thou taken the fuyu?" asked the miller. "I have that," replied Gilbert, "a bushel to every bowl." "I don't believe a word of the boy's mouth," said the cunning old miller to himself. "When I have taken the winkers off the mare, I will take the fuyu myself." The mare was put in the fay, and the father went to the hopper to take the fuyu a second time. Just as the measure was put in the corn, a long doo, a blackbird, let on a branch of the drine above the open window and sang out, "Miller and Droch Spirit, Miller and Droch Spirit, Miller and Droch Spirit, the fuyu de keet, eh? The fuyu de keet, eh?" Nämlich gleich erweihen, nämlich gleich erweihen, nämlich gleich. The Landau always sings in the Gaelic. The miller, hearing the Landau, as he thought, saying, Miller the wicked one, they will take the fool you twice, eh? They will take the fool you twice. I will tell. He was made afraid by the song of the Landau, and at once laid down the measure. He made up his mind to be honest in future. Just as the bird was taking to the wing up towards Cronk Ikilaban, singing as he went, Nimish Gish Arwalin, Nimish Gish, Nimish Gish, Nimish Gish. Here are two extracts from a short story written in 1897 by the Reverend T. E. Brown. It has never been published in book form. The story tells about two families in Kirkpatrick Parish that had farms alongside each other, the Christians of Ballabeg and the Quirks of Ballamore. The heir of Ballamore was Richard, and the heiress of Ballabeg was Nelly. And why shouldn't the two quarterlands be made into one big farm? So the parents of both put their heads together and arranged a marriage. Richard was very pleased, but Nelly was not. Richard was fond of Nelly, but Nelly, somehow or another, didn't respond. But the fathers and mothers, feeling certain that the girl would come too, at the end, made all the arrangements for the wedding. Here is a discussion about making a deed of settlement betwixt the parents of the young pair. So the time went on, though, and the old people began to think about the wedding. And Quail Dusty come via one night, and the talk that was at them was just terrible. And this and that, and settling and fixing, and the girl there too, but not the boy. And how about the fortune? And couldn't the Christians be raising some money on the Ballabeg? And bond and security and stock and crop. And to it they went again. Settlements and papers and property and leases and basis and improvements and bet interests and mortgages and wills and testaments and widows' rights and executors and trustees and insured and offshored and overboard. And have you got much property, sir? No, none of me. My gough, I don't own a rap. Land, all right. Land, all right. I'd be willing of it enough if it wasn't for all this dirt of law there's about. Clap it in me hand, this land. I leg a chow of tombaga in me hand, and in me mouth at once if you like, and I can do it with it to the full. But to have it all crawling and creeping about you like worms, like crags, like slugs, like spiders, like a spitz, like a blue difference in turpentine? Oh, no, no. Much obliged, your humble servant, sir. I don't want your land. But these farmers, that's the way they are. They're born with the land like a skin to them, and a middling tough one. I'd as soon be born with a straight waistcoat. Pursuing them, and they can't help themselves. I believe that night they hammered it all out till there wasn't a pin betwixt them. Old Harris, Queen Barris, every stick, and every penny, to the very dog and mitten. The banns were called for 3 Sundays in Kirkpatrick Church. On the morning of the wedding, there were lots of people belonging to the parish of the church, the parson and the clerk, and everything jesh, expecting the big wedding. Richie was there, but Nelly was not. They waited and waited for her, but she didn't come. Peggy Force, she'll be coming yet, Richie kept saying. Peggy Force, Peggy Force. Then a messenger came to say that Nelly had taken the mare and gig and was seen driving southwards over the Derby Road, and no wedding took place. And for why couldn't Nelly love him? Oh dear, oh dear. Is that a question to be asked now? Well, don't ask it from me, for I can't tell you. But I'll ask you a question, and answer me. Can you buy love in a shop? Over the counter? Does the druggist make it up in bottles with when taken to be well shaken? Eh? Are they marking it a poison? Love. This love. Can you get an ounce of it? Or must you take a barrel, like it'll be the stock of herons? Or is it out in the fields you'll be after it, like these old women after herbs in the moonlight? Or do you catch it in the air like raisins? Or is it floating about like these little fine strings of silk we're calling snowen to? Oh no, if you've got it, you've got it. And if you haven't, oh, it's not in for you. That's it, that's it. Love is just love, dear. Throwing down his cap. I wonder if there is anything like this folk story recorded elsewhere. The story was told by my mother. There was once a gardener working at Kintrech, and his name was Richard Caron. He was very fond of a girl living at Tossicaly named Eleanor Cannell, and he wanted to marry her. On Saturday evenings he would be going down the meadows by Colby River, and she would be coming up by the same river and meeting him. Richard was very jealous when he would see Eleanor talking to another fella. One fine Saturday evening, he was walking down by the river as usual, and he saw in the distance Eleanor coming along. To his great annoyance, he saw that she was linked to Joe Lees. He was very jealous